full complement of about 30 already. So shall we make a start, Jan, if you're happy?
Of course. If for whatever reason I cut out, William, if you could start either raising your hand or making some sort of dramatic sign, that would be great. First and foremost, thank you so very much to the Association of European Journalists and William, also to you, for this very kind invitation. You've not given me an easy topic. I've been asked to make some opening remarks about the interrelationship between media freedom and the rule of law. This is something that I have to think about in a number of different capacities. In my work as a barrister representing journalists at risk and international media organisations, the question is a central one, but it's very much a practical day-to-day concern, as I'll come on to by reference to a number of specific examples. But then in my work as a university lecturer, when I'm teaching the right to freedom of expression as protected in international law, the question is no less central, but it arises principally at the conceptual level. In my newish capacity as a member of the high-level panel of legal experts on media freedom, I've been grappling with both the practical and the conceptual with my colleagues to try to formulate some real concrete recommendations to states who are committed both to the rule of law and to the promotion and protection of media freedom. But the question, William, that you've asked me to cover has, I think, to be considered set against the very stark realities that we face today. We, at least in the United Kingdom, are on the verge of going into another lockdown. COVID-19 seems to be on the rampage again across Europe and also across the world. The pandemic, this will be known to everyone here, it's being used by many governments, democratic, non-democratic, as a pretext to suppress independent media voices, to silence opposition, to silence dissent, to silence the truth, all while the world is looking away. And of course, we have a day to go to the US election, the country of Jefferson and the First Amendment, where the President of the United States has characterized the press as the true enemy of the people. Reviewing parts of this call, reminding myself the authors of the 2020 edition of RSF's World Press Freedom had to say about recent developments. And I think they identify the coming decade as one that's going to be decisive for the future of the media. They posit in their report overview, suggests that we're at a crossroads, and I think it's very easy to sympathise that position and that assessment. The report doesn't make for happy reading. I mean, that report has not made for happy reading for a few years now. But this year, the authors have identified five distinct crises, and I think it's important to go through them quickly. First, there's the geopolitical crisis for journalism. This has been caused by the sheer aggressiveness of authoritarian regimes in making every effort possible to suppress information, to suppress opposition voices and independent media. I think Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt currently sit as the states with the world's biggest jailers of journalists. But secondly, of course, there's a technological crisis for journalism. The absence of any appropriate, as yet appropriate, regulation in the era we're going through of a digitalized and globalized communication has really created information chaos. So we now see propaganda, we see advertising, we see rumor, and we see journalism all in direct competition with each other, vying for our attention. But then we also see state troll armies being unleashed. So social media in the hands of these individuals, paid for by the state often, becomes not a way in which to disseminate the truth, but it becomes a vicious weapon for intimidation of journalists, for the spread of disinformation. We've all seen the effects of this in, for instance, Russia and India. I've been witnessing very closely the coordinated deployment of these sorts of weapons against journalists in the Philippines, including against my client, Maria Ressa. Thirdly, there's a democratic crisis for journalism. Leading politicians and those close to them are continuing to openly foment hatred of journalists. The media is the true opposition. Sometimes, they say, the media are operating at the beck and call of often identified foreign powers. This then leads to the fourth crisis, the crisis of trust in the media. And the authors of the RSF Index cite the Edelman Trust Barometer, which studies the public's interest in institutions. 57% of the people polled in its latest international survey thought that the media that they consumed were contaminated with untrustworthy information. And finally, of course, there's the economic crisis that the media is facing. We're seeing sales falling, we're seeing a collapse in advertising revenue, and at the same time you see a concomitant increase in production and distribution costs. All of those factors forcing news organisations to restructure, and really what that means is laying off journalists. And that in turn can only lead to the impoverishment of quality journalism and investigative journalism. So media freedom is clearly under threat. One then turns to see the state of the rule of law internationally. Also under threat. Is that a coincidence? I say no, it isn't. And that is because the two principles, the two values, are inextricably bound up together. They enjoy a mutually symbiotic relationship. And I'm going to explain some of the reasons why I say that is so, and then I'll close before our discussion starts, just explaining how some of these considerations have informed our work on the high-level panel. So the rule of law, a weighty and ponderous term, but what does it actually mean? I mean, it's much cited by politicians, it's much cited by journalists, it's much cited by lawyers and judges, but it's often misused, and sometimes its meaning is so stretched as to become meaningless, just verbiage. I can tell you what it means for the authoritarian leader. The authoritarian leader thinks that the rule of law means nothing but the blind obedience to the law, even if that law is arbitrary. A law is a law is a law, and so on. According to judges in Nazi Germany, the Nuremberg decree stripping German Jews of their rights as citizens had to be obeyed because it was the law. The same was said of South Africa's apartheid laws. The same was said of slave laws in the United States. Lawyers sometimes refer to this grandly as legal positivism, a way of thinking that doesn't ask if a law is fair, it doesn't ask if a law is reasonable or compatible with fundamental rights. It just asks whether it is the law. The late and, to say, very great British judge, Lord Bingham of Cornhill, had a very persuasive answer to that way of thinking. I'm just going to quote to you from his book on the rule of law. There Lord Bingham observed, "A state which savagely represses or persecutes sections of its people cannot, in my view, be regarded as observing the rule of law, even if the transport of the persecuted minority to the concentration camp or the compulsory exposure of female children on the mountainside is subject to detailed laws duly enacted and scrupulously observed." There have been others who have argued that the rule of law stands for the proposition that laws must be obeyed if and only if They've been made by a democratically elected legislature. Well, I'm afraid the rebuttal to that view is an obvious one, and it's informed by our history. A democratically elected legislature may abuse its powers and violate the rule of law, may do away with democracy altogether. The Third Reich was democratically elected. So what is the rule of law? When we say that a state is governed by the rule of law, I think we mean much more than its outward forms of legality. The Soviet Constitution famously proclaimed a wider range of civil and political rights, but infamously, it provided no protection in practice against the abuse of power in the name of the motherland. The rule of law, in its true sense, requires justice for all who seek it. All laws must be publicly proclaimed and accessible so that ordinary people have a fair warning of the law's demands and can regulate their behaviour accordingly. Equally, there must be access to justice, access to an independent judiciary and to an independent legal profession. Ordinary people must be able to seek judicial review of decisions taken by governments and administrators in their name. Legal proceedings must take place in public. The administration of justice must be informed by the principles of openness and transparency. Just pausing there. Openness and transparency are, of course, impossible in a system where media freedom doesn't exist. In other words, media freedom is essential for the rule of law to be able to operate or function in any meaningful sense. Free press has to be able to report, has to be able to scrutinise what's happening in the courts without risk of punishment. A free press has to be able to report on matters of public interest so as to enable people to test the legality of their local and central government's actions before independent courts. And writers and journalists have to be free to comment where they have grounds to believe that there's been a miscarriage of justice. There's a very good and, I think, modern example of this. Consider government surveillance. So a few years ago, I was involved in a case that I'm sure some of the delegates here will be familiar with, where a number of non-governmental organisations were bringing a challenge to the United Kingdom's bulk data collection programmes. It was the first real litigation challenging government mass surveillance as it operates in the United Kingdom. That case ended up before the European Court of Human Rights, and that court ruled that those programmes were unlawful because they failed to incorporate adequate privacy safeguards and adequate oversight as a matter of convention law. It was the first ruling by any international court of the UK's mass surveillance programmes, and it's a good instance of the rule of law in operation. And in this instance, it was the international rule of law. But none of that could have been possible without a free press. The very existence of those programmes and some of the details as to how they operated was first published by the Washington Post and the Guardian. We would never have known, let alone would we have been able to mount a legal challenge to test the legality of those systems. Another example of the interrelationship between the rule of law and media freedom, this time actually at a conceptual level. Consider this. It's the role of independent lawyers and judges to help the people hold the powerful to account. Of course, it's also one of the functions of a free and impartial press. So it should come as no surprise to any of us that when governments seek to increase their grip on power, when they seek to increase their grip on independent institutions, they seek control over the courts, as well as over the media. Governments that seek to silence journalists also move against independent lawyers, also move against judges and human rights defenders. And that's why any deterioration that one records in any given state is either deterioration, obviously, in the rule of law, is either precipitated or accompanied by a deterioration in media freedom. So the two principles are inextricably linked, and they serve as the two pillars holding up the democratic order. So where the rule of law is under threat, so too invariably is media freedom. There is a link, and it's an inextricable one. Just want to close by making a few comments about how these considerations have informed our work on the high-level panel, with a view then to into a discussion. This panel, for those who are not aware, still existence, was convened at the request of the United Kingdom and Canada. It was a rare instance of a state-backed initiative. The panel forms a part of that initiative, and it's entirely independent of those two states, as well as the 36 other states that have signed on to the coalition. We're ultimately just a group of legal experts, but we're drawn from all over the world. The panel itself is chaired by Lord Neuberger, the former president of the UK Supreme Court, and its deputy chair is Amal Clooney. Other members include the former vice president of the European Court of Human Rights, former minister of justice for Canada, and a former president of the Constitutional Court, Colombia. Our remit, well, we've been asked to provide specific recommendations to states to prevent and reverse abuses of media freedom. And we're going to propose concrete steps that can be taken by states to help reverse the current course, as I set out at the beginning of my remarks. We're trying to do that in a number of ways. And for instance, and I'd be very keen to discuss this in the next segment, but I've been leading the panel's efforts to formulate specific recommendations to states for the provision of safe refuge to journalists at risk. This is an issue that's been identified by us as absolutely critical to media freedom. Every year, we see scores of journalists being forced to leave their countries to escape threats to their safety. And of course, those threats have only arisen because they perform their duties as journalists to report the truth and to inform the public on matters of public interest. But at the moment, although scores of journalists can leave and find safe refuge, for every journalist who finds safe refuge, there are scores who are unable to find safe refuge. The current framework of protection in international law doesn't work. Journalists at risk in their home states, in practice, face huge obstacles in finding safe refuge abroad while they remain at risk at home. My recommendations, which have been approved by the panel, will be published in a few weeks' time, seek to put in place, in part, a new system that responds specifically to the challenges, as well as a number of steps that can be taken to address problems in an existing system, to strengthen those existing systems. That's just one area. We're looking at ways also in which to strengthen consular assistance to journalists at risk. We're also looking at promoting a more effective investigation tool to abuses against journalists. But of course, underpinning and informing all of our work is our recognition that addressing threats to media freedom must necessarily entail addressing threats to the rule of law, because no media can be truly free in a country where there is no respect for the rule of law. And in turn, the rule of law cannot operate, at least not for long, in any country where the media is no longer free. Thank you very much indeed.
I've succeeded in unmuting myself before I speak. That's unusual for a moderator. Jan, thank you very much indeed. That was extremely lucid, and you covered a huge amount of ground, as you promised, touching on a few examples, but I'm sure our participants would love to hear you talking in a little bit more detail on some of them. You have told us that you would like to have the Q&A session on Chatham House Rule background rather than for quotation, which we of course respect. I wonder whether I might though ask you one sort of follow-up question, which is very much about the implementation of these international standards, which you said are now not working. And perhaps if you could answer a rather generic question along those lines about what you hope or what you believe that the panel's work might do to shift that balance, so that member states who hide behind the idea of sovereignty or patriotism or simply making the enemy of the others might be somehow obliged through political as well as legal means to comply with their own commitments. And of course, the great majority of countries in the world have actually ratified the International Covenant Civil and Political Rights, the number one part of that human rights framework, and a great many are in regional organizations like the Council of Europe and the Inter-American System and the African Union, for that matter, which do have very high standards and have courts as well. You've represented people in the ECOWAS court as well as in Turkey, your country of birth, and so on. If it's not pushing you too much, might I ask you to answer that point in your own way about how you improve compliance and enforcement against this climate?
William, thank you. Ultimately, there's no point in a panel such as this, or in an overarching initiative such as this, if efforts are going to be confined to championing media freedom in speeches. And such has been the deterioration in compliance, such has been the deterioration in enforcement, even by states that traditionally enjoy a good reputation or strong reputation for promoting and protecting media freedom, that we really have reached a crossroads. The United Kingdom and Canada have taken a bold step by initiating this project and by persuading countries to sign on. But the project and the initiative only becomes meaningful if it results in concrete change. And the one of the purposes of the high-level panel is to study in great detail the existing position. So, for instance, in the one of the reports that I'm leading on visas, to look at what the legal position is vis-a-vis safe refuge of journalists, but then to look at what the legal practices are vis-a-vis safe refuge journalists, to find the gaps and then to persuade those states to plug those gaps. We are not going to be able, as a panel of independent experts, to persuade every state to completely rehaul its policy on asylum and refugees, for instance, which is the first thing that one thinks about when you think about safe refuge for journalists. But in fact, there are a whole host of other steps, very effective steps, that can be taken by states. Some states are already doing it. And one of the things that we're very sensitive to is also to highlight good state practice and to try to incentivize other states to follow good state practice, for which we need to find leader states. And that's really how this initiative is hoped to work. I mean, we will be doing the analysis. We will then be doing the advocacy, both publicly, but also privately to states, I was in a conversation last week with the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Canada, talking to him with our team, with Lord Neuberger, Mark Clooney, with Baroness Kennedy, to investigate how we can take some of these recommendations forward. We're also in talks with the United Kingdom, we're in talks with other states as well. So we are not an NGO, and our recommendations are focused on state actors. And our hope is that with these concrete recommendations, if a sufficient number of states either take them on board or show to us that they're already taking them on board in their existing systems, then that is a very helpful parallel framework, William, to the UN, to the European system of protection, to the African system of protection. But it's focused, of course, on media freedom alone. Whereas we see today, and I put my barrister hat back on, you know, a huge systemic problem is the number of cases that international courts and tribunals have to deal with. And the fact that justice delayed is justice denied. And why is there such a delay? It's because domestic legal systems are not providing recourse at the domestic level. And therefore these international courts, which aren't appeal courts, are being flooded with claims that really should be capable of resolution at the domestic level. So for that reason, the international system is under huge stress and huge strain. And that's why post the UN system, post the system constructed following the Second World War, states, including compliance states, really have to show leadership. And the panel is one modest way of trying to get that to come about in this area.
That makes absolutely excellent sense. Again, stop me if you really want to go to background on this final question from me, because one of the topics of your panel is perhaps the most sensitive of all, which is international investigations, cross-border investigations into cases of the most serious abuse which have been met with impunity for a long time. One thinks of the Khashoggi case, Daphne Caruana Galizia in Malta, a host of others. Perhaps if in that same vein, with your legal hat on, you might just talk again about how it's possible to move the goalpost, move the equation a bit in that most sensitive area for states, into, so to speak, pushing their justice systems to deliver.
William, thank you. That is a very, very sensitive area. It's one that we are grappling with, but it's an area where we are also in conversations not only with states, but some other actors who've done a lot of fantastic work in this area. Agnès Callamard is a good example of someone who has worked very, very hard, both in the Khashoggi case, but also in other cases. I am very sensitive to not stealing the thunder of my co-panelist Nadeem Houri, who is putting the finishing touches to his report, and I've been privy to that report, and therefore I don't want to touch centrally on. I'll give you the gist of where we're coming from this, but all I can say is it's definitely the area that we found one of the most challenging in coming up with concrete recommendations. And there are, you know, it's not just the cases at the extreme, and that's the problem. There are so many cases, and we even have issues knowing about moves against journalists. There are certain jurisdictions where you just would not know because it's not reported. And sometimes it's complete accident. And I think that is a serious concern, especially for journalists not working for international media organisations. It's very difficult. I know that's an unsatisfactory answer at this stage, but I'm just very, very sensitive that a huge amount of work has gone into this, and actually a huge amount of debate, which I can't go behind, has gone into this at the panel level. And therefore, I would like to give Nadim and the team full opportunity. That report is going to be launched at the meeting of the International Bar Association, and I'm going to be on that panel launching it, and therefore I'd welcome any tricky questions at that stage in a couple of weeks from any of the delegates.
I think that may be on November 23rd and 25th, if I'm not mistaken.
25th.